Thank you very much for your patience. I'm really sorry about this delay. It was my fault, of course, but I thought a different time and I realized it later. So thank you very much, Adrien, for the introduction, and thank you all for the patience and the energy of being here at this hour of the night. Adrien already introduced you to what I do with the Codate. I teach also at the University of Bologna. I teach architectural design to fifth year architectural engineering students. Mostly what we do in Codate in Computational Design Italy is to, we are interested into the impact of computation in a lot of fields, and we see a lot of interconnection and influences between one activity that we perform in a certain field and how it reverberates across the entire spectrum of the thing that we do. So we basically seek connection patterns between architecture design, which is mostly the disciplines where we all started or where we all come from, and all the possible fields that are entangled with it. We had a wide range of collaboration, a wide spectrum of disciplines, from medicines to arts to science to design. So we had, and we still have the possibility to move transdisciplinary into this territory. The first thing that I would like to talk about is a little bit about the concept of technology, tools, and techniques. Since when we deal with computation, we deal with something that is very visible in terms of technological impact, and it's something that it's always a sort of a central question between the fetish for technology and the dependency that powerful technology can cause on the work that we do, how much we have control over them, how much these technologies instead control us. And the topic was not a new one, in fact. It's something that even Frank Lloyd Wright started to question. And he was talking about, I think that, I think it caught up with with something. So he was talking about the machine, meaning the means of industrial production, automatization, serial production. So he was aware that these kind of technology had a huge impact on the work of an architect. He was very much a man of his age, and he wanted to push through this technology to build an architecture of its time. But in general, we can also think about the machine as to translate the machine for our contemporary times with something that is less physical and even more belonging to a more digital or abstract plane, like even machine learning, like software, like artificial intelligence, and all this kind of stuff. So in a more general stance, we can say that technology has always defined what are the operational boundaries of the design space. It doesn't shape the results, not necessarily, but certainly the way we operate and the boundaries that we have are something that is implicated in the technology that we use. And even so, this kind of mutual influence between, or mutual, if you want, effect between the technology that we are symbiotic with and the way in which we shape them and they reshape us in return is something that also changes even the perception and the boundary between the self and the other meaning in general something that it's something outside of the self, a conception that for all purposes we maintain very much even in the 21st centuries, our general perception of the relation between the body and the rest of the world is pretty much the same that it was in the Renaissance, with a sort of a pure body and the rest outside, while even in many fields of biology, of technology, of sociology, this concept, and somehow even the concept of the cyborg, something that has a more queer definition of the boundaries between the body and the rest, also reshapes the relation with tools and technology. Jussi Parikka is an entomologist. Sorry, so he's talking about also the way in which biological species uses tools as a means for their end. So for all purposes, tools are organ. I mean, you can conceive a tool as an external organ of the body and an organ as an internal tool of the body. And also, sometimes there is also this debate about technology and the way we use it. And to that extent, I would say that the possibilities that technology can open are somehow depending on the technology that we use. So there is no full substitutive logic in my opinion. There is no technology that can that some technology can do something that other technology can't. So, and this is resumed at this dialogue from Gattaca, in which they come out of the concert and he says to her, two fingers or one is how you play. And she says, that piece can only be played with 12 fingers, because the pianist has 12 fingers. I don't know if you've seen Gattaca, but if you remember this scene, that it's, I mean, you might play as good as it comes, but if something is supposed to be played with something that you don't have, you need to have that at hand. So this relation of technology, it's intertwined with the way we design architecture, or it was, historically speaking. This is the reconstruction of the construction structure of the Santa Maria del Fiore by Brunelleschi, in a rendition by somebody else, but the rendition is of the structure. But I wanted to talk about with this picture is that Brunelleschi had to design also the way his project had to be constructed up to the structure for the construction site, up to the scaffold. Right, so the scaffold is a tool, and the tool is symbiotic with the project, and symbiotic with the architecture. In the progress of the centuries, especially with, because of many conceptual cuts that have been made throughout history, but these cuts have been particularly reinforced and torn apart by the strength of the Industrial Revolution and the serial production, there is this connection between design and also design, the tools with which we do the design. This part of the project has been disconnected by the project, so the project has shifted more on a conceptual level and separated by the making phase. So designing and making have taken long ago different paths, but these paths have been progressively separated between each other until recently. What you see here is the state of the art, so to speak. This is the robotic lab at the ETH in Zurich, and this rift that has been created between designing and making as a way of let's say the possibility of bridging back between these two might be offered by the application and of computation throughout the process. And learning to design through the use of computation, through the explicit application of computation, is something that requires several changes in the paradigms and in the mindset. First of all, because what computation does, essentially, is trying to compress infinite quantities of data in finite sets of operations. which is somehow also the work that we try to do when we try to make sense of an environment. We only catch what we are able to catch of an environment. We really do not know everything that we are missing out. We didn't know what was happening at the atomic scale until we found a way of looking to that, and we had all kind of wild ideas that were not accurate, but then we corrected them in time. So the first ingression of computation in the design was something that was all in all reinforcing certain paradigms. So this is the sketchpad, one of the maybe the first CAD system envisioned by Ivan Sutherland at MIT in 1963, that was replicating from the user side the paradigm that was mostly known and used in existence, which is the pencil, the table, the sheet. So the user gestures were an extension of the existing paradigm through which the design was expressed. But, and you can see that on the right side of the slide, the real way in which the program was working, it was building, let's say, a user interface with a paradigm the user could understand, but the way in which the program was working was completely different. And it was working through a set of instructions, through a set of behaviors, through a set of operations that were taking decisions and helping the user, because it was not just plotting points. Sketchpad was already kind of intelligent, so it was actually trying to figure out if you were trying to make a straight line or an arc or a curve, and automatically straightening the line or adjusting the curve or doing all these sort of things that would have come much later in the mass diffuse program. But this is still a paradigm in which there is a direct command to the tool, and the tool is just a passive receiver that has to execute this sort of thing. Not specifically in Sketchpad, but the conception, the mainstream conception of CAD is that it is a passive tool. It has to come to von Neumann machines that were invented more or less or in the same period to deal with another concept that is the opening to the concept of complexity, so that the things could not be determined in advance. There was an argument in that period in which the first formulation of the concept of emergence were made, in which things could self-organize, then create something. And so the detractors of this concept were putting out forward the argument that for a machine to self-reproduce, it would need a description, an entire description of the machine, which would then have in itself nested another description of the machine, and so forth, ad libitum, generating something that it's an impossibility because it leads to an infinite amount of data to be generated. Until von Neumann came up exactly with a scheme of a self-reproducing machine, by all means destroying the argument against emergence. So the interest that I have in computation especially is not because of the possibility of just automating something that can be already done, but by the fact that through repetition to programming behaviors, through the exploiting the generation of complexity, there is a form of creative upscaling. It's really just taking it to the nth power. And the chance to do something that it's impossible to do otherwise. Back in 1967, there was a group of artists, and we are more or less in the period of Sutherland, we're more or less in the period of von Neumann. It was a period of an extreme openness to exploration, because it was the period in which more or less Alan Turing did his papers. Everybody was working at the Bell Lab there. Shannon and Weaver came up with the binary code. Pretty much the birth of the computer age is there. But the idea of the computer was already so powerful that it influenced the sphere of art. And the artists like Sol Levitt, like Vera Molnar and others, were interested into, okay, what if we, instead of doing the work of art, we build a machine that does the work of art. So Sol Levitt comes up with this sentence in his paragraph of conceptual art. The idea becomes a machine that makes the art. And by machine, he was meaning what is called an abstract machine, the abstract formulation, which is a set of instruction. So this is his set of instruction for one of his wall drawing. So he just writes this instruction, and this is what he generates as from his side. And then these instructions are sent to the gallery. The gallery puts up a team, and then they do the work of art. So the machine is the set of instructions, but all in all, it's like building a real machine, except it's made of instructions that people can follow, but you can build a machine that can follow the same instruction. And there's also a question, a way of questioning intelligence and the figure, the so far indestructible figure of the author. So if I can write something that builds something else, am I the author, or does the authorship spreads otherwise? But the thing is that through this kind of machine operations, the interesting thing is not anymore to explore just what I can reach with my imagination, but explore through the relentlessness of the operation of the machine something that can go beyond my realm of imagination. So it's something that I like to call the inhuman tension, which is to explore exactly what the machine can add to my human perception, to explore the non-human world, which is a translation into the inhuman. So to paragraph Sol Levitt, the way in which we try to work at Codate, or the way in which I try to work, is the fact use the code to design machine that grow the architecture or the design or what we want to do, not to reproduce something that we would do otherwise, but to try to explore novel perspective. And in this case, our authorship or our contribution goes into a much more granular level and distributes into choices that we made when we write algorithms, when we write code, into these two sort of things. Something that are procedures, condition of operation, or you can think about something, the way something moves. So they are dynamic, they are speculative. And criteria, they are much more like boundaries. So in one way, we can decide how something moves and which are the limits of its operability. So in this case, the algorithms becomes not just passive instruction, but they become modes of thought, becomes way in which we can build thought. And the logic that we put into the algorithm becomes a sort of an aesthetic operation, not so much because they can engender their own aesthetic, and also because with a certain kind of algorithm that I will of which I will show some example of in a moment cannot be understood unless you see them in action. You cannot trace or you cannot understand what an algorithm does just by reading the algorithm. You have to experience it in action. Just as with music, you cannot, unless you're very experienced, but this comes with your experience, you cannot have the musical experience just by reading a score. You have to listen to it. So what we do is can be summarized into programming behaviors to guide the generation of form through what we refer to as transformative processes involving materiality. I will leave the sentence here because it's much more clear to pick it up further on and expand on it in front of an example. The other thing that I want to argue for before showing a few examples is the notion of craft that mostly is understood as a way of operating with the hands. You can find a lot of definition of craft that involve the handwork or a reference to hands in particular. But to me, it involves more a sort of a sensibility of the body, which is a sensibility in general, which is not just rational thought, but it has to do also with intuitivity. And craft, it's not an exclusive territory of the hands. It can be exerted also in writing code and in many other activities, because the way I define it is it's an accumulation of knowledge that then sublimates into a form of sensibility. So it doesn't come out in the form of rational formulation of knowledge, but rather can come out as a muscle memory or intuitive gestures. Think about musicians, think about the way a writer can write something. So the knowledge that everyone gather at some point can be expressed in the form of this kind of sensibility. And the more you exert it, the more you refine this sensibility and the more your craft evolves. So for us, in general, computation is not just a single subject or a tool, is in all a design medium. Medium is Latin, not English. So it's a design medium. So it has a double significance of a territory and a mean. So it's both a new territory. Whenever we explore it, we find that there are areas that are still unknown. And it, at the same time, it is the mean through which we explore that same territory. And coming to more specifically to our interest into architecture, there is a specific part in which we are interested into, which is tectonics. And you can think about something that is, in general, at the opposite spectrum of stereometry. So with stereometry, the matter is some sort of inner thing. You cut the shape out of the material and you get your shape out of a, let's say, a more or less indifferentiated block. With the tectonics, we take almost the opposite stance, in which things, instead of being born by subtraction, are born by formation, by progressive growth and aggregation. And assemblies, which are the general focus of a tectonic approach, can occur also, in this case, coordinated not by a central intelligence, but by distributed small choices by individuals, but that then collectively organize, like in the case of these fire ants, to form bridges or columns or structures. So they coordinate forming, all in all, something that has properties that exceed the property of the single individual. And in this case, there are two keywords that can describe the qualities of this assembly. One is that it is rigorous, because it's born out of rigorous operation, because there is no, let's say, each ant executes a certain kind of behavior specifically, and they execute all the same kind of behavior, but then this leads to something that has a set of qualities that exceed them. And the other, that it is also anexact. Not inexact, but anexact. So to explain that, just this little scheme. So if you think about exactitude or something exact, you think about like the classic Euclidean shapes, like a circle. Inexact would be try to reach a goal, have an ideal, but have an imperfect way of operating. So a very bad circle drawn by hand by somebody who is not Giotto, for instance. And anexact, it's Actually, the opposite of inexact. Inexact has a goal, but it's not rigorous in its means. Anexact is rigorous in the proceeding, but it doesn't have a determinacy or a finality. It's not trying to reproduce something perfect, but it has like a principle of curvature that it can rigorously preserve through its proceeding without the aim of producing a larger shape in general. So there are two characteristics. One is like vagueness, that is not lack of logic, but lack of finality. I don't have a final goal, but there is an intrinsic logic of operation. And anexact, which is the rigorosity, but without, let's say, an ideal of perfection. And there's this sculpture that kind of, I think, explains in a visual way quite accurately both concepts, because there is a rigorous operation of construction. It's made off of two kinds of material, garden hoses and zip ties, and the way in which they form an assemblage is incredibly rigorous, but then it sways and it goes in many different directions, and it doesn't describe something that is easy to describe or digest in one picture. Yet you see that this complexity has an underlying order of growth of proceeding. And the same kind of order that can be expressed by the complexity of biological structure, it's strictly and inherently the result of iterated and repeated behavior. So building, construction, and the tectonics that we find in the structure that we see in biology are the result of the iteration of very, very simple instructions. And this is like, for example, the sequence of operation that a spider uses to build its web. Or this is, for instance, another species called the weaver ants. They use aphids. They hold them in their mouth and they tap them with their antenna to let them secrete this fluid that is a glue that holds together leaves. So all in all, you can see an animal holding another animal and using it as a 3D printer and programming it with his antenna. So by tapping it, it induces more or less secretion to form something that is very intricate, which is their nests. So they pick up leaves and they put them together and they use this gluing method to stitch the leaves together. And this is a species which, let's say, if you consider the brain capacity and the amount of brain cells, it's something that is order of magnitudes below the mammals, below the human. But they can build the structure that have a sophistication that we have still a lot of struggle to get. What I'd like to talk about and I'd like to catch from this example is the capacity of obtaining this complexity and this sophistication out of the interoperation of simple instruction executed by a large number of individual, large number of objects. So it's the possibility to access complexity that is beyond the capacity of imagination of a my single brain, but to obtain it through what is called also swarm intelligence. And also exploits something in terms of construction that has to do with a slightly, let's say, readapted concept of tectonics, which is looking at tectonics as the territory in which the relation amongst form, by all means the shape that we see, and the internal organization and the internal logic in which things work are engendered. So in other words, tectonics is what correlates metabolism and morphology. So if you design something, you draw something, then you have to make it work according to the functions and the energies that these functions require. You have to come up with a structure, with a form of organization that can, in reproduce that form. So if the two things are completely unrelated, you get some relation that are very forced. But in all the structure that we've seen, the things are pretty much tight, pretty much symbiotic. But in order to start also to understand what kind of, in order to also to build up some sort of filter, critical filter for to analyze the what we've seen in biological structures, there is a shift that we need to make from a tectonic made of purely elements, the classic tectonic that understand the structural elements, then surface elements, then decoration elements or ornament elements. Everything is included into separate objects, to something that has to do more with behavior. So on the left, you have a typical example that is readable through a tectonic of elements, like the Campanile di Giotto, everything from the Renaissance, for instance. So you can very clearly distinguish and separate the structural parts from the marble cladding, from or in the in a more let's say special constructive scale, the windows, the several volumes stacked upon each other. So everything is organized by just juxtaposition, stacking. Okay, you can take out every individual part has its own identity, but then they just relate by coincidence of position. On the right, there is another tower, which is a model made by Fraiotto. It's a study model in which you cannot apply the same kind of reading, because if you do so, you will, if you are, read it by elements, you see that it's made out of all identical elements, except the properties of this model do not coincide with the properties of that single element. They are not homogeneous. They are very heterogeneous, and they depend on the organization. Moreover, you can distinguish, though, not what elements form the structure and what elements form something else, but you can understand structural behavior. So if you start thinking how the structure behaves in such an object, then you can see that there are flows in which the structure can work, and in the same position, if you look at another behavior, at the behavior of how it's forming a volume, or if it's forming an enclosure, then you see that the same elements perform different function, different work at the same time. So you cannot anymore separate one element for every function, one element for every part of the tectonic system, but you can read it seeing how these kind of behavior are distributed throughout the system. And the good thing is that you can do the same thing with the campanile, with the fact that these behaviors are encapsulated into the object, but it doesn't negate the possibility of reading the other the more traditional architecture of Giotto. After this little bit stressed introduction, I would like to go through some examples, both from the work that we are doing and we have done in the recent past at CODATE, especially having the chance to work with the robotic arm. And initially the project at some point fell into this collaboration between different entities of which we were part of, under the general label of Digifab Turing. So our interest was mainly to experiment with three different kind of materials. One is clay, one is biological material, and the other one is plastic, PLA in that case. But our interest was not just to take any kind of object or project and reproduce the object as it is. It's more to explore this kind of loop through. So we design, we start from the top for this thing. So the first thing is we start designing machine behaviors. So we're not interested into shaping an object and then slicing it for printing and sending it to the robot, but to design how the robot behaves. then this behavior must somehow not consider the material as a passive receiver of shape, but engage the material's morphogenetic capacity. So if you extrude clay or plastic in a certain way, it might be very stable because you extrude it in a way that its self-organizing properties are unable to express themselves. But if you change the way the machine behaves, at some point the material has the possibility of doing something that you cannot yet predict from the design phase. You cannot simulate the full behavior of the material. Then there is the part of assessment and evaluation, in which I've put a subtitle which is human and non-human, because on one side there is an assessment made by us, on the other hand there can be an assessment made in the future by machine learning algorithms, by any other form of analyzing and filtering the result, giving out maybe results that we were not able to perceive, so expanding for our purpose the range of possibilities. And these assessments are reinforcing the design sensibility that then goes back to the top, and the loop repeats. So we designed the tool to control directly the robot behavior, to simulate the robot behavior so that we are able to understand how to change some design parameters, like, for instance, changing the pattern of velocity of the pattern in which of the angles of the head of the robot towards the plane. And for instance, this was one of the results. The extrusion pattern is just an helix that revolves around the cylinder. What changes here is just the speed of the robotic arm. So the flow of the material is constant throughout all the extrusion, but then when you start slowing down, the material needs to organize the excess of material in the same space. And then you start seeing the lumps that are appearing. So, and then the head starts accelerating again, and then it forms the more regular rings that you used to see in regular 3D printing, but by tweaking these changes of speed, we could get out this sort of effects and exploit them for other results. So in this case, there is a crisscross pattern that creates this sort of, let's say, checkered or lozenge pattern on the side. And this also has a consequence on the structural resistance of the piece, because then the parts are crisscrossing in an alternate fashion, so it creates a much more solid wall. And then other experiments, just by changing, in this case, it's just by changing the speed of the head, dramatically in one case, more subtly in another, or by changing the layer height, or like in these cases, using a different set of nozzles. So this was something it was a chef nozzle to do pastry. So by changing the relative rotation of the nozzle with the trajectory, you get all these sort of effects. And then the experiments went on, and we experiment also with imposing some sort of patterning on the object. This is a set of experiments that we did with some reaction diffusion patterns on the surface. Some of them also went into glazing. Some experiments also with how gravity interacts with some sort of with the most obvious shape, or trying to keep always the nozzle perpendicular to the direction of extrusion and see which angle we could get. Just experiment with the direction. Then we did some experiments also with polymers, with the translucent polymers, or printing in midair to generate a beam in this case. and the beam is two something, 1.50 meters, and it's very lightweight. It's 297 grams, and pretty resistant. Also, some of the design was applied into the design of lamps. And another part was working with biological material, and for this we put up a collaboration with Officina Corpuscoli. The head of Officina Corpuscoli is Maurizio Montalti, which is a designer from Italy, but he works in Netherlands. And it's especially he has specialized in working with mycelium. So the bowl that you see here is a bowl that is made out of mycelium, out of dried mycelium. Dried mycelium is a very interesting material because it can for many characteristics substitute plastic. So there are several fields in which this design is carried on. So we put up a collaboration with Maurizio, other people like Mirko Dall'Uzzo, Sonia Baumel, and Wasp to do a workshop in Amsterdam, where we were printing a base for the growth of an organism called the Fusarium polycephalum, which is best known as a slime mold. And we did some experiment because we wanted to see in which ways the let's say biological intelligence was interacting with some choices made at the level of design. And then we started to experiment with using the robot to print environments that the mycelium could colonize. So you see the progressive colonization. Once the colonization has happened and the mycelium has dried, these objects are incredibly lightweight and stiff. The problem is that we are still on the benchmark phase, mostly because the possibility of doing this sort of experiments is not a possibility that we have every day, and it requires a lot of work to tweak the characteristic of the material that we still haven't had the hang of. So there's a lot of work to do on the level of the material, especially, but the principle, right now, we're happy because the principle is working. And we're also working with experiment with flexible matter, which is what happens when you put two material system, one that is working with tension and the other that works with bending. So mostly experimenting with bending active structure, just like the leaves that you see from the weaver ends. So we've put up this drum to print on stretched lycra. And then when you release the lycra, the pattern creates some self-organizing three-dimensional shapes. So according to the way you design the pattern, the distance, the stiffness, we did a workshop, the 3 days workshop, and these were all the results that we gathered in those days, which was kind of a very wide and absolutely non-systematic at that point experimental base, but our intention is to try to systematize it a bit more. And this is one of the things that came out of the investigation, so that you're working on a scale in which even the arrangement of the fibers in the fabric have a different influence, even if the pattern is symmetric, is polar symmetric. The effects are not because the fabric is organized in a square grid. So we designed a series of objects out of that, and we're still in the process of experimenting. So the next set of projects that I want to show are not the work of Code8, but the work of some of my thesis students at the University of Bologna that still relate to this. So there is a lot more speculative work, if you want, but it works on a different scale. So the first one is a thesis of a guy called Eugenio Bettucchi, And it started from the exploration of the process of stigmergy. So how agents interact not among themselves, but with an environment, leaving traces in an environment and reading those traces. So initially, there is all sorts of experiments to understand how the reading and writing of this information in an environment leads to self-organizing patterns. So there is nothing in the information that the agents are using that describes this pattern in any way. They emerge out of the interaction. And then the next step is to try to use this pattern to progressively build up something in three dimension. So see what happens when they accumulate, not only in time, but when they accumulate in a vertical direction. And to try to bring this to the physical reality, the experiment was to set up this feedback loop in which there is a robot that is extruding foam. Then with a Kinect, it's able to scan the foam, because the foam has a way of behaving that cannot be completely simulated. So you cannot predict the entire simulation, the entire behavior of the material, and we didn't want the machine to just operate by a completely predefined script. We wanted the machine to be able to see and decide one iteration after the next what to do. So after the first iteration and the material behavior, to decide what was the next thing to do. So the robot had to extrude the foam, and then it would go in a position in which the Kinect could scan the foam, and then the algorithm reading the cloud of points would decide what to do. Then there was like a speculative part. Unfortunately, I didn't put them in here. There is there was a short part of a physical exploration. I mean, we did manage to do something, but unfortunately, the access to the robot was too erratic, and it took a lot of time to set up. And we came up with a lot of errors and a lot of mistakes. I hope to have. Sorry, that is my fault, because I wanted to put also the mistakes in here. But I don't have them. But the first, let me tell you this, the first time that we tried it, we discovered that the nozzle is so sensible that basically the can of foam exploded in the lab and everybody was soaked in foam, just because there was this little extra pressure. So even to make sense of that, or working with the material, we discovered that there is something that we couldn't foresee at the beginning, that when you use canned foam, the more you use the foam, the more the gas expands, so the more pressure you need to apply to get the same amount of material out of the nozzle. We are talking about like micro entities of force, so to regulate this kind of thing, just to have a bit more regularity in the trajectory, was really, really, it took weeks, even months. So this is why, in terms of results, at the end, there is a lot more on the speculative side and a lot less, because it proved to be a lot more difficult than we thought in the beginning. But this is part of the deal. I mean, it's part and parcel of the process. You go through experimentation, you fail, you learn. Another thesis was dealing instead with aerial construction. So using fiber composite and drones to make structures in areas that are difficult to access otherwise, when you cannot build a construction site. So in this case, the use of drones and fiber composite was coupled with the use of inflatables, because inflatables can be brought on site very, very effectively. You can inflate them on site. They don't occupy much space. And then you can use them using the drones to wind the fibers around them. And so by changing some characteristics in the mesh representing the inflatable, the drone was able to read these characteristics, and because they come from, for example, stress analysis and other kind of information that it's compressed into the mesh in form of color. Well, anyway, no, I think I took away the video and then left the part. But anyway, this was the. Oh no, it is a video. It is going. Sorry. So in order to fabricate this, there should be in any way a sort of deconstruction in parts, because otherwise it's when you scale up things, try to make things out of a single act, it's counterproductive from many points of view. And then there is the simulation of this swarm of drones winding the fiber around the inflatable. There's all sort of analysis and cuts, and this was the. Ooh, I didn't put the. Man, I forgot all the videos. Sorry, because the guy actually did. Oh, let me see if it's. If I just skip the slide or. No, it's not there. Man, sorry, I'm so bad in this. It's totally my fault because the Samuel, the thesis student. Did a working model using a drone and winding the object around the drone. If after the we finish the lecture, if you want, if there is time, I can search the video and play it. Another one was similar, but still working with swarm intelligence at the structural and architectural level. In this case, with the agents that operated around membranes, self-organizing into structural patterns. So this is the part of the structural analysis, and each of the agents that you've seen has a very simple body shape that then organizes and starts to clip to form larger ensembles and larger organized structure. So there's this part of analysis, a part of comparing results under different conditions, and also introducing into the agent body the constraints for fabrication. In this case, the agents were supposed to be fabricated by wire bending. So there is the minimum length for welding them together. The angle of bending was introduced as a constraint in the object. And in the end, he produced the scheme for this prototype. That is coupled with a membrane that is thermoformed around the agents. So that you don't just form like a skeleton of something, you also form the skin, but out of the skeleton. And the project was applied for a thermal bath site. So you need just the canopies to, let's say, mitigate the climate, not to form enclosures. Oh, in this case, I didn't forget to put the videos of the fabrication. So in this case, you see the man helping the machine because normally the machine is used to bend thicker wires. So the wires were very thin, and so to avoid the machine skipping turning the wire, the man is assisting. Then all the parts were tagged, pre-assembled, then soldered, welded. This is the author of the thesis with the other two thesis students that pretty much helped. They formed a team. So each other, they helped each other finishing their own thesis, which was a very nice thing. So they temporarily locked the pieces in place with zip ties, then they soldered everything, and then they removed the ties. And as the last thing, they did the skin. Yeah, not a very clean soldering, but you know. And that's lastly the thermoform skin. So this is something that I have to tell them. They built everything, they did everything in-house, because unfortunately at the University of Bologna, it pains me to say this, but we don't have a proper lab for doing this thing. So we had to borrow the robot for how much we could from a robotic lab, but it's their lab, so we cannot have a continuous access. And all of these were done basically at home by these guys. And these are the pictures of the finished prototype. And you can see also the quality of the thermoformed part. It came out very clean, all in all. And I think this is the last one that I want to show. And this is another thesis that has to do with discrete parts and assemblies, but it starts with the exploration of a reaction diffusion process in space. So how you can drive reaction diffusion, make it anisotropic, and learn how to distribute these values. And these values plus a lot other kind of information generated or chosen as a design driver were incorporated in a model that then was expressing not exactly the typical isomesh that is used to visualize distribution in space or to give body to a distribution in space. So the output was not really this. This was just a visualization mean. But the output was really then the assembly of very simple parts that operate in the same voxel space. So basically, the space is divided in discrete unit called voxels. And very simple elements are assigned to a voxel. And according to the information in each voxel, the specific element is picked, oriented, and then the result becomes an organized assembly. This was the very simple element that was used in the end for the thesis. It's the idea was to build these things in very simple pieces of wood. So there is the design of the detail and the joint that precedes the project operation, because from the design of the detail, then by consequence, the project grows up and forms its own aesthetic. So we needed a design that could perform angles and bending and maintain certain stiffness. So we came up with this kind of infill that are cut in the perpendicular direction of the angle, so they are one piece instead of being joined. So you can join the two parts that are making a sort of a sandwich outside. While in the process, when these things start to come up, some recalls to the architecture of Carlo Scarpa in Ca' Foscari came up, actually. Because all in all, the level of intensification of detail recalls the work of Scarpa in there. But then, thanks to the possibility of putting a system at work relentlessly and with a huge number of parts and for a lot of time, it's not just anymore placing something in a voxel in space, but then having these objects placed in space to have some properties by which they search the space around and then they start growing and developing without intersecting, but in some cases starting to join together but without interfering, and join and building larger structures. So each one of these objects has a particular set of behaviors that look around and see if they can grow in a straight direction, if they bend, or if they change direction at all, and then they are divided into discrete parts. So this is like the typical model of the loaded, the loaded beam, the classical loaded beam with the distributed stress on top. And this is the interpretation of the system of the distribution of elements and material to respond to the stress. So the system has a way of interpreting a diagram. In that case, was a very simple volumetric structural diagram. And in this case, the diagram comes from different sets of information overlapped together. And then Giovanni, the thesis student, started to experiment seeing how large it could grow, like how many elements it could put in the system before the computer crashed at all. And it grew pretty large. Until then, it finalized in a much more refined version of it in a sort of a model of a house. In this model, there is also the ambition of trying to, let's say, fine-tune the system so that at some point it could interface with much more market-ready elements, like glazing, like stairs, like furniture. So the system is not something that stays in a world that it's completely independent from anything else, but has the possibility to adapt, so you can say where, okay, this is where I'm gonna have the frontier, the glazing, so the system can adapt so that he has the joints so that you can put the glass in there, or a door, or anything else. So it was an experiment of trying to see if you could, on one side, push the system to a computational level of detail that was quite sophisticated, on the other hand, to be able to push itself on the other side towards more, let's say, market-ready application in a way. So these are the two most recent work that I followed, two theses. This one, in a way, picks up the topic of assembly of discrete elements and fiber composites on the other side. And it starts from the analysis of a very simple process called diffusion-limited aggregation, in which you start with a particle in space and then there are particles moving around. If another particle arrives in the range of interaction of the stuck particle, the other particle stucks and then it becomes fixed. And the process repeats and you can see the growth that you see on the right side of the video over time. I don't know why. Well, so growing up this process and trying again to control it, not just letting it go randomly, but trying to control the general direction and convolution of growth, and of course incrementing a lot the number of elements that are involved. The idea was trying to make some highly redundant and highly volumetric and expressive structures, but made out of very, very, very simple elements. In this case, the elements are represented by simple line segments. So these structures are made all exclusively by line segments. Then there is the part where there are parameters where you can control the direction, the density, the amount of interconnection between the parts. The thing is, when you deal with this sort of structure that are made out of lines, one of the most difficult thing is to represent them. Like, how do you know what's going on in there? So it was really difficult to, and we didn't solve the problem completely. But in some ways, we find ways to make more sense out of it. So there was the first experiment of directing the growth and introducing again volumetric information for the system to read, and starting to, while starting to gain a better control, started to see what the system could do at an architectural scale. Example of columns or other aggregations. And then there was a study of how to build this stuff. So instead of leaving it in a, let's say, in just a single line state, the idea was to transform every line into a strip of fiber composite, of carbon fiber specifically. So each line connects two nodes of the system. But each node has several lines converging in the point. And the idea is to find for each of the nodes a sort of an average plane, so that each strip could be comprised between two planes that have a relative rotation between them that doesn't never goes above 90 degrees. So the maximum torsion that you can have in one of these elements is 90 degrees. Because then the several elements can be glued together in the nodes. So you can build up a structure. You just need to keep the strip constrained, the carbon fiber strip constrained when it cures, so that when it's stiff, it maintains perfectly the angle. And the thing is that in this way, we started to visualize what the structure can do, and we need to understand if there was a poor interconnection. Like, for instance, if you see at the bottom, there are long lines of single elements after single elements, and that is, of course, a weak chain. So that part would need a lot more interconnection. And start building the harnesses to do this. Again, the poor guy didn't have access to a specific lab to do this sort of thing, so he did this at home, building this concoction that can be regulated at a precise angle, so you can constrain the strip at a precise angle, and occupying for almost a month his poor mother's oven to cure the pieces. And the first pieces, he realized that when they cure, first they kind of melt, so they slouch a lot. But then, if you keep them with a little tension, then you can use them and assemble the model. So this was like the prototype model, demonstrative prototype model. And also, he built like a more comprehensive design for a canopy, which is this one. And it's visualized like this, just because otherwise it's very difficult to understand. It was the first thing that he could do to give a sense of visualization. But the structure is even more lightweight. It's not so. This looks like it's extruded in metal, for instance. But instead, it has a much more transparent quality. And just to visualize it, he did a 3D printed voxel model of it. This one is the last, and this picks up where the thesis of Eugenio stopped with the robot extruding foam. We wanted to make to let's say pick up from there, from the part of scanning and making sense of a deposited material to build something else. So Matteo investigated the process of Stigmergy again in 3D space, and more specifically, introducing the possibility of working by extruding on rule surfaces, because then you have a possibility to grow larger with less material. Another thing that we realized is that to build up in scale, you need a lot of foam, as you do when you do additive fabrication like this. If you're going to grow up in scale, there's a lot of material that you have to pour. So to reduce the ratio of the extruded foam, the idea was to use the foam to reinforce ruled surfaces. Ruled surfaces also because they can be robotically cut and in a fast and easy way, relatively easy way. So you can grow larger structure faster and with a much more sound economy. And so it started also investigate the difference between a synchronous agency, so launching all the agents at the same time, and the non-synchronous agency. So since they write information in the environment, you can also launch them one at a time, and they will read the information that the other have left, but progressively. So agent after agent after agent, they start building something. So they interfere less with each other simultaneously, but they build still something that makes structural sense. So there is the rig that was used for the scanning, some let's say a test piece, a benchmark with the structural information and the trajectory that are building up. Building up some simple behavior in the beginning that then becomes more and more evolved, more and more complex to make sense of the possibility of building bridges between trajectories to reinforce the structure in the cross way. And then he started to use this trajectory to drive the extrusion for the first test. And the first test, this is all the, let's say, closing the loop from the extrusion to the point cloud to the trajectory generation. So the first test proved quite successful, because you see that in the top left picture, he has the sheet before the extrusion, and the same sheet with one extrusion and another kind of extrusion, but just the sheet and the extrusion of foam, and you can see the effect of stiffening that the foam has just by attaching to the sheet. And it's paper and not even fiber composite. So the rig this time doesn't rely on foam cans, but on cartridges of two components that mix in a nozzle. So instead of having the volatility of the foam before, it's much more controllable. But in the end, since we had to extrude the one or at best two layers, and because of the erratic access that we could have with the robot, we had the possibility to go again at Wasp, because it's close to Bologna also, and have more time to spend with the 3 meter. No, actually, this is the 5 meter delta. It has an area, a printing area of 1.5 meters. So, but for the purpose of the exploration, I mean, the process is the same, because you drive the machine to do that, and with the robot would have been pretty much the same thing. So we could also have a lot more control with the other foam setup, changing the flow of the foam, and so deciding if something could happen in a certain way according to the expansion of the foam. And also controlling the extrusion pattern a lot more and a lot more efficiently. So in the end, the process of producing a demonstrator, a prototype, ended up with this. So the idea is that you could make and fraction a larger shape into several panels. The logic can be calculated on the entire object, but can be used in fractions, in elements. So you can build in parts and then reassemble the parts in the big element, because then you use the fiber composite to make a continuous joint. So you can deposit the foam, and then you build the prototype Not with the hot wire and the foam, but since it's a ruled surface, he did it with cardboard and strings, and then putting, sorry, plywood and strings, and putting cardboard on top. And this is the prototype in the making under the Delta. At the architectural level, this was speculated to be some sort of space enhancer. So more or less like some of the recent park pavilions that are being built around. So this could be a sort of a way of distributing space, articulating space better in an open place, making some enclosures, making something covered, but having the quality of translucency and the structural slash ornamental pattern that comes from the extrusion of the foam. So this ended up being the prototypes. It's 2.3 meter by 1.5 with this stratification. And the total weight is more or less 2.5 kilograms and stiff. So this is the finished prototype, and this shows the translucency property that we were looking for. Okay, that's the last slide. Thank you for resisting all this time.